So now I will ask if there's any announcements. Okay. I'll just remind everybody that the AGU meeting is coming up. I will send out an email that describes the various sessions and workshops that we're going to have, and possibly give a little bit more detail, so people who are going can sort of think about where they want to go. And also, there is all of the sessions, the climate literacy sessions, are going to be video on demand. What I don't know is whether you'll be able to see it in real time, but you certainly will be able to see recordings of all the sessions. So you could potentially look that up. And actually, I'll try to find out the details of that to see if I can sort of send that out. The other thing is, I don't know if anybody from NASA NICE is on the phone, but we're going to have a webinar preview of AGU on Thursday, of which I'm participating in, but I don't know if it's okay with them for me to share the phone number with people here and see if other people are interested in participating. I'll find that out too. Is there anybody from NASA on the phone now? Okay, well, I'll find out. Okay, are there any other announcements? Okay, well, if not, then we'll move on to our presentation for today. So Mona Bell, I hope that's pronouncing your name correctly, is a multicultural and interdisciplinary scientist who leads the Texas Sea Grants Research Program. She also works as a climate change scientist with the Sea Grant Extension Team. And prior to assuming these roles, she worked as a visiting fellow with the American Meteorological Society Policy Program, was an adjunct professor at American Public University, and she's also an award-winning teacher. And she's going to be talking to us today about reflections on Expert Witness Advocacy Training Academy, and the abstract and slides are on the website. I sent the URL out earlier, so I hope you can find the slides. And so, Mona, with that, I will turn it over to you. I will remind you, if you can, to say what slide numbers you're on so that people who come in late might be able to see them.
Sure. Thank you, Tamara. So thank you all very much for giving me the opportunity to share my experience. I believe that this topic may be one way of looking at science through a discipline-specific lens, in this case, the discipline being law. I hope you find this talk useful. So I am on slide number 2, which just shows a picture of William Mitchell College of Law. So with support provided from NSF's Paleoclimate Program, William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota, launched a training and education workshop that prepares scientists to provide expert testimony in a variety of settings, including but not limited to the courtroom. I got the opportunity to participate twice in this workshop, first in the year 2011 as a participant, and then this year as a fellow. What follows in the slides to come are my reflections from this workshop. So I'm going to move on to slide number 3. The Academy is based on a practicum exercise that is used to provide a hands-on experience involving the law and resolution of legal issues relative to this case. Scientists are trained in courtroom techniques, practices, and procedures. Participants of this workshop perform exercises by role-playing as scientists and attorneys. The instructors at William Mitchell educate and coach the participants by discussing and analyzing the roles of scientists and attorneys in a courtroom. The 5-day workshop involves depositions, legislative hearing, arbitration, Daubert hearing, and a culmination with jury trial. The workshop is very unique because the academic experts get an opportunity to understand and reevaluate the role as expert witnesses from the standpoint of non-experts, in this case, the non-experts being judges, lawyers, and the jury. So one of the most important skills that participants learn in this workshop is argument and that is how to argue effectively and ethically. I'll move on to slide number 4 that talks about the scientific method versus the judicial method. So I'd like to speak in more details about what I took away from this workshop. The first lesson being that there are fundamental differences between the cultures, the values, and the languages of science and law. So beginning with the basic definition of the term law. To a lawyer, law means rules established by properly constituted social authority. To a scientist, law is a statement that is derived from relentless observations of nature, of how nature works, and that is assumed to be both permanent and universal. In law, there is always an answer, and the answer exists at a certain time, that is, at the end of the court action. In science, there may never be an answer, and certainly no answer expected within a given frame of time. A scientist considers his or her work as a working hypothesis that is continuously subject to revision and refinement as a result of peer review process. Another difference is that although both science and law seek to arrive at conclusions based on rational reasoning that is derived from evidence, yet the very word evidence has different meaning in these two disciplines. For lawyers, evidence is a type of proof which is intended to convince the judge and or the jury of the alleged fact material to the case via oral testimony. A scientist defines evidence as the observational data on which conclusions can be drawn. So science and law differ in their fundamental goals as well. The goal of science is truth, and that of law is justice. But the approach of fact-finding is very different in these two disciplines. With so many how are the judges validity of what is, whether something should be admitted as an evidence in court, given that they have limited or perhaps no scientific training or experience? So moving on to the next slide, I just want to say that science does provide answers to the most pressing problems in the 21st century, yet there are so many political actions without scientific backings. For example, irradiation of food protection, selection of diagnostic tools for characterization and treatment of diseases. These are just a few examples. I'll come back to more this topic in a few slides again. I want to move on to the slide that speaks about the expert witness testimony, that is slide number 6. So going back to how do judges and lawyers decide what is valid scientific evidence and what is not? That is where an expert witness comes into picture. An expert testimony is required in legal cases to help the jury or the judge in determining disputed factual scientific issues or public policy issues that are resting on disputed facts. An expert testimony may also be required in an arbitration, in an administrative proceeding, or at a legislative hearing. In courtrooms, one party may present their expert testimony through direct examination. That is a question-answer style of presentation. The opposing party tries to show that the expert is not worthy of belief because of weaknesses in expert credentials, omissions in expert data, or errors in experts' research techniques, or any other problem with the expert testimony. What is the purpose of an expert testimony? Well, the expert provides the decision maker with the facts, explanation of the scientific method, that is the principles, theory, and testing procedures of science. An expert is also able to apply his or her academic background and training to the facts of the case and render an opinion about the facts. So who is considered to be an expert? An expert is defined as a person who has specialized skills, knowledge, education, training, or experience in science that is beyond the ordinary knowledge of lay people. In case where conflicting expert opinions about the issue are in dispute, it may be likely that the expert's credentials may be extensively examined and tested in front of a judge in a pre-trial evidentiary hearing that I will speak about. It's called the Daubert hearing in a federal court. So there's an important legal concept which is called the burden of proof. That is, the government must prove that an individual defendant is guilty of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt. The civil plaintiff must provide enough evidence to persuade a jury that each element of the plaintiff's legal claim is more likely than not exists. Now, this is very conflicting with science because the way science works is in a far more rigorous manner, with concepts of evidence and standards that are far more demanding than asking that a fact be proved more likely than not. So that's a big challenge for an expert testifying in a legal proceedings. And when a scientist or an expert is subject to such a proceeding, it may be very tempting for scientists to take sides when subjected to this adversarial system such as law. And this may lead some experts to make normative statements rather than positive ones. Think about it. Lawyers have bulk of control over what gets communicated in the courtroom. Their questions for direct and cross-examinations are crafted in such a way that it presents the sharpest side of each story, of the story. And that is presented in such a way that either the judge or the jury can be persuaded. So this can be an ethically troubling experience for a scientist. So there are ethical obligations that the expert needs to latch on to. Now I want to move on to the next slide, which is also related to something that I spoke of earlier, that's connected to use and misuse of science, and this is the admissibility of expert testimony. So the relationship of science and law can be stormy. People in black robes look warily when people in white lab coats enter the courtroom. The institution of science and law are very far apart intellectually. That is what I learned at this academy. Let me provide you an example. This is also related to the misuse of science. So I'd like to discuss a case which is called Daubert versus Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals. You may have heard about this case earlier, but the case involved Benedictine, a drug manufactured by Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals and used for severe morning sickness. Now, the plaintiff claimed that Benedictine was associated with birth defects. The litigation went forward, and one of the results was that Merrill Dow ended up pulling Benedictine from the market. Yet there had been no toxicological research to find out whether there was any connection whatsoever between Benedictine and birth defects. The Supreme Court revised the standards for the admissibility of expert evidence in Daubert, holding that judges must serve as gatekeepers by evaluating the basis for scientific evidence before admitting it into the courtroom. Prior to Daubert, the standard used for admissibility of expert testimony was derived from a case which is called Fry versus the United States. The general acceptance test required a judge to determine whether the scientific technique used to produce the evidence was generally accepted in the pertinent field. Thus, in that case, all that the judge had to do was find out the pertinent field and inquire as to its general acceptance. The problem with Fry was that it depended on the self-assessment of a group on whether that group's own activities were valid. The Daubert Court, on the other hand, expects the judges to act as gatekeepers of sound science. Instead of simply determining whether a scientific technique is generally accepted, judges are now expected to understand the science themselves. Daubert was, in that sense, revolutionary because it put an end to judges' abdication of their responsibility to access the reliability of scientific evidence. The problem is that courts have been inundated with civil cases involving scientific evidence. And that brings me to my last slide, which is possibilities for future improvement. So when you think of these questions as to how do we bring science to better serve the courts, and how better and more frequently use expert witnesses, something that comes to mind is that people perhaps need a better understanding of the scientific method. Perhaps they need to understand better how science works. What do words like evidence, hypotheses, law, theory mean in science? What are the differences between positive and normative questions? Maybe policymakers and people coming from a legal background need some science education. Scientists also need to understand their roles better so that they can be ethical, effective, efficient teachers and communicators. That's my brief presentation. I can answer any questions that you might have. I'm not sure how useful this might have been, but I do feel that there is a need to look at science from a very discipline-specific lens. So, are there any
questions? This is Tamara. Do you have any examples of cases in which climate change evidence or climate change issues were part of the conversation?
Yes. Well, there is an example. I don't think there are too many that exist, but there are a few examples that I'm happy to send out via email. There are papers. There is a paper written by Jonathan Overpeck from the University of Arizona. And his paper is basically on adaptation, and it's called Adaptation and the Courtroom. It's judging climate science, and that is basically on this issue of climate change issues, that are being involved in litigation.
How do you think that, there's this issue of scientific uncertainty, and maybe this is addressing some of the pharmaceutical cases, but how does the legal system deal with this issue of scientific uncertainty?
And that is a problem too, Tamara. I guess that is one of the issues that this academy was trying to address. That having the lawyers and judges realize that we define scientific uncertainty. It's different. It's how we define uncertainty is very different from how non-scientists or laypersons perceive uncertainty. So I guess one of the I don't think it's a resolved issue. I think the whole the academy is in place so as to teach lawyers and judges that this is how science works. And there is, when it comes to climate science, well, many issues are at least the fundamental questions that are related to climate science are resolved. There is, there is no uncertainty when it comes to some of the fundamental issues in climate science. So I guess it's an issue of education.
I would suspect that those things that are really settled science aren't those kinds of things that will end up in a courtroom. They'll probably be more along the lines of what's causing the change in a particular region, and is it the fault of some company and their strategies for their strategies for impacting the environment or not. And there's probably a lot of scientific uncertainty in terms of saying how much and so forth, so on and so forth.
Right.
That's just a guess on my part. I don't know. So are there other questions from others?
This is Scott. I was just going to ask about the case with Michael Mann, if you remember. I believe he was charged with, and I can't even remember the terms of this thing, where I think there was a court proceeding against him as a scientist and some of the information that he was providing. He was certainly challenged on a professional basis. Mona, do you remember anything about that case and how, you know, that played out?
I am sorry, Scott. I have heard about it, but I regret that I haven't really read too much into it. But again, this. So, you know, like I said, it's interesting to.
Mona, we're losing a lot of your words. At least I am.
Yeah, I am too.
Yes.
Oh, could you just say what you were just saying again? Because half of your words got garbled.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, was the presentation clear at all?
Yeah, there was one section that was a little bit, but most of it was just fine. So, but just ask, just make your comments again about, you know, this last minute or so, because I couldn't understand what you were saying.
Sure thing. I said, the case on Michael Mann, I am not sure I was telling Scott that I'm not sure about the status of that case, or I haven't really followed. One of the goals of this this training academy was to bring up issues such as that, where, you know, what is the role of an expert witness? How when a scientist or an academic expert, when he or she is subject to an adversarial setting, you know, how easy it is to take sides, and rather than just stating facts and laying options, how you are more tempted to lean either one way or the other, and you know, sometimes you lose credibility.
Mona, here's a slightly different question. I'm curious whether there's anyone that's tracking the call for expert witnesses around climate change. I suspect that what will start to happen, and you were kind of alluding to it before, is that we will start seeing claims that, you know, such and such a plant has caused, global warming that has impacted somebody's crops or some part of their business. And one of the questions will be, how do you make that causal link from the individual action to something that is much more global? And, you know, I think we as scientists sort of understand how these things are connected, but I can see enormous problems for the legal community in trying to assess, blame and then hence some sort of, compensation for those things. And I think it's just going to become more and more of an issue as we start seeing the impact of climate change. Have you seen anything talking about that kind of stuff?
You're absolutely right, Scott. Yes, people are talking about that stuff. I think AAAS, they did work with the American Bar Association. I'm not quite sure about that, but they did work with the legal professional organization to work on in the challenges in the science, provide and answers ethically. So I'm not sure, roster. I do know that the National Justice Institute, AAAS.
Ramona, are you talking directly into a speaker, because your sentences are coming and going?
Oh, okay. Well,
I'm sorry.
Better?
No problem. I am so sorry about this.
Yeah, that's better.
Okay. Like I said, so the AAAS and the National Academy of Science are at least the two organizations that I do know work on these kind of issues. I'm not sure if they maintain a roster of expert witnesses from around the country or not, but they do. They have addressed. NRC has a report on the interface of science and law, and AAAS works with the American Bar Association to address issues, challenges, and so on and so forth in the science law interface.
Yeah, I mean, that's the, I think the take-home message maybe for many of us is well, I don't know whether we'll be asked to be expert witnesses, but yeah, it just seems like this could become a very big growth industry, you know, for what it's worth.
Right.
It is.
So,
yep,
so Mona, on one of your slides on the expert witness testimony side, there's some questions, and one of them is what are the ethical obligations of expert witnesses? Could you sort of speak a little bit more about that in terms of sort of getting us thinking about what might be the ethical obligations as an expert witness versus going to a school or community group and conveying scientific information?
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, you know, like I said, there's a lot at stake when you are an expert. I mean, your reputation is at stake, and that's one of the reasons why people, you know, shy away from being an expert. I mean, there's a lot of money, of course. You do get paid. I've heard, you know, there's financial stake. But anyway, when it comes to ethical obligations, an expert is the way I perceived, this is what I learned, took away from this workshop, was that an expert would be an honest broker of information. So, you know, just stating the scientific facts. Now, that is very difficult. Stating scientific facts, I guess, is not challenging at all. But, you know, how do you state your opinion in such a manner that, you know, it doesn't, you don't take, you're not taking sides, neither this way nor that way. So that's where, you know, an ethical trouble would come into picture, where a well-established scientist who has published a lot, you know, they have a great reputation, yet they, you know, they're confident about their results, and they do want to, you know, lean more towards one side or the other. So an ethical obligation of an expert would be to be as objective as possible, to make positive statements, and to explain science in the most objective way as possible, to be able to explain people that, you know, this is how science works. So and the other thing to, you know, like I stated, the other thing to remember is that lawyers will have bulk control over what gets communicated in the courtroom. So while if you're an expert witness in a direct examination, you know, those questions will be more descriptive, but a cross examination is designed in such a way that it attacks your credibility. It attacks the way you may have done science. It's an attack, and at that time you are very much tempted to you know, either take sides or you know, try and make you're tempted to make statements that are not really scientific, that are not factual, but that are more normative and bring in your, you know, they speak of your values and things like that. So I guess those aspects can be ethically troubling for a scientist. The other important thing to remember is that, you know, like I said, law looks at science at a particular instant of time, and science is never resolved at any given time. So, you know, how do you make a statement? You spoke of uncertainty. How do you explain science in a particular realm of time? Again, those are tricky things that scientists need to be very, very careful, you know, when they interact with a broader audience, whether it is legal experts or, you know, anybody who's a non-scientist. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, sure. Are there other questions?
Well, this is Scott again. What this reminds me of is the whole climate gate. If you remember the emails from East Anglia, and the notion that when another group of people look at what is, you know, the sort of normal chatter between scientists, especially with our kind of at times loose language, at least it's maybe not to ourselves, but when somebody else reads it out of context, they see it in, and especially with certain kinds of glasses, they will see it in a different way. I think that's that's a kind of an interesting kind of clash of cultures here. And, you know, when you have a particular point of view that you want to express within the court system, then we have, you know, some real difficulties here. And I don't know whether it tells us as scientists that we have to be really careful what we say in our emails, or we just have to, you know, in some ways educate the legal system on what's the nature of the give and take that happens within scientific discussion. I don't know.
I think, Scott, those are great points. I think it's important to address both those things. I think scientists need to be very careful. I mean, my mentor at AMS policy program in Washington, D.C. always said that every scientist should, when he or she composes an email, he or she should think that they're communicating not only to their scientific colleague, but to, you know, to everybody. That email is going to be read by each and every single person. So that, you know, that just makes you much more responsible as to what you put down, you know, on an email, and it's a lot of responsibility. And the other point, like you brought up, I think it's very important for us as scientists to educate people about the scientific method. I think there is last week I was speaking with John Nielsen Gaiman, who is a drought expert, and he said the same issue, that rather than, I mean, people, yes, they do need to understand temperature and precipitation and what happens when these things change and whatnot, but I think people really do not understand how science works. I don't necessarily think that people have a good understanding of the scientific method. I don't think that people understand what, you know, hypotheses is, or you know, how an experiment works and how much, you know, that science is never resolved. And, you know, I just don't think a normal layperson has that understanding. So it's important, you know, I guess to address both those issues. Scientists need to be more disciplined in their communication, whether it's in a classroom or with their colleagues or to a much broader audience. And I guess it's also important, it's an obligation, perhaps, I personally feel, of every scientist to better educate, you know, other disciplines as well.
I can sort of carry on.
I think of... Hi, this is Jane, and I was just thinking how important this is with the NGSF and
yes.
with mm-hmm. the science and engineering practices, especially the emphasis on the different kinds of questions that scientists are in a position to answer. This
mm-hmm.
business about the difference between positive and normative questions, for instance, is
mm-hmm.
a thing that can be tied in on those NGSS practices. In a broader context, there's the nature of science, which is
Definitely.
What you're saying we need the public to understand more, is in
mm-hmm.
the AAAS documents. I don't know how much those are going to be emphasized as the NGSS rolls out, but
mm-hmm.
certainly
mm-hmm.
at least bringing that forward in this group is well received, I think.
Well, Jane, what this also suggests is that one of the things we need to do in our institutions is trying to engage perhaps the lawyers also. You know, if we're at the university level, we're obviously teaching to science majors, but there may be an opportunity to then engage lawyers and sort of encourage them to see, you know, basically have a bit of a scientific method or at least some sort of introduction to the way scientists work. Now, I know that's a little bit out of NGSS, but, you know, it's the same themes that we want to teach in K-12. We probably need to have in some sort of introduction to the scientific method for lawyers or something like that. And I don't know whether any institutions are actually doing that within law school. It would be very interesting. Find out. Does anyone know of any law schools that are paying particular attention to the scientific evidence?
Well, I just know that William Mitchell started to...
And
sorry,
there's
go ahead.
A environmental law group there, but I can't say that they specialize in science so much as are applications to environmental situations and legal decisions related to pollution, things like that.
That's the Conservation Law Foundation.
Which group is this?
At Ohio State. There's many student kind of constituent organizations in the College of Law, and one of them had one of our scientists come and present the scientific basis for climate change last year, and then they had some speakers on environmental law designed for students who have an interest in that, but the scientific, kind of the nature of scientific testimony comes into play.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, this is Gene Fry. There's a group called the Conservation Law Foundation headquartered in Boston. It's sponsored many expert witnesses, the lawyers. They also put out, you know, summarized scientific information outside the courtroom as well. So that's...
Is that intended for information for lawyers? Is that intended for information for lawyers, or is that intended to give scientists a view of how they should frame their input?
They are an advocacy group, headed at least by lawyers. Not everyone who works there is a lawyer, but they are an environmental advocacy group that, in regulatory proceedings primarily, and perhaps in the laws, all trying to get laws passed, also brings to bear what they see as relevant scientific and other information. And occasionally the witnesses they sponsor, which they don't do very often, could include scientists.
Mm-hmm.
I've testified before commissions. I've been on commission staff and cross-examined various other people, although most of the ones I've cross-examined, William Nordhaus and Lester Lave, Lave was epidemiologist. Nordhaus is more of a forestry and economics guy.
What were the kind of cases that you were doing?
Well, that one, which is more than 20 years ago, was assigning dollars per ton damages to carbon dioxide and other substances like sulfur, SO2, and carbon monoxide and so forth. And utility companies, and actually sponsored testimony that could be construed as on opposite sides of the case. The electric companies sponsored lower numbers, and the gas company sponsored higher numbers.
When you say sponsored, what do you mean? What do you mean by sponsored lower numbers or higher numbers?
They, as parties in the regulatory proceeding, would hire expert witnesses. William Nordhaus and Lester Lave were hired by the electric utility companies in Massachusetts, and Paul Chernick and Bruce Ewald were hired by Boston Gas companies to provide higher estimates using a different methodology. I think the first one sponsored by the electric companies used damage cost estimates such as they were, and the one sponsored by the gas company use something based on backing out the cost to comply with regulations. So that's just a bit of my experience, and I've cross-examined those witnesses, read lots of stuff, and in the process I asked for many studies, which I also read. I've been on the other side of that fence a few years before that, back in the 80s.
So, Mona, what drew you to this program? Did you have the opportunity to be an expert witness, or are you working with people who are expert witnesses?
No, I was still a student in 2011. I attended the AMS Summer Policy Colloquium, and Dr. Dave Verardo, who is the director for the Atmospheric and Geospace Sciences Unit Division at NSF, was one of the speakers, and he informed us participants about this opportunity. So You know, it was just intriguing for me to understand, you know, as a scientist, what is an expert witness. I'd never heard as a graduate student.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I graduated and worked in the policy arena for some time in Washington, D.C., and now with Texas Sea Grant, I just feel that I work in the science-society interface where I personally feel as a scientist, I do feel the responsibility of educating and communicating science properly and ethically, and I think this was a great experience. It was almost, I think I've said this before, it was almost an out-of-body experience as a scientist to look at, you know, to attend this academy and acted as an attorney asking questions, direct or cross-examining my own colleagues. It just felt as though I was asking questions to myself. And, you know, it was just a great opportunity to get into the mind of a non-scientist, and especially in this case being, you know, that non-scientist being an attorney, and see how they question you. And it was just, you know, a mind-blowing experience in that regard as to, you know, how does a non-scientist view a scientist and what goes on in the mind of a non-scientist, you know, when they're asking questions to a scientist and trying to understand their science. So it's been a great learning experience, I believe, and it's helped me a lot, personally.
A note from my experience, often the lawyers will have some other kind of scientist advising them what questions to ask of the science whose testimony is currently before them.
Right, and we were also taught that when we were acting as expert witnesses, we were also taught that we can, while working with attorneys from our side of the case, for example, I was an expert witness with the plaintiff, I could work with the attorney of my side and tell them that, you know, during a direct examination, please ask me this question so that I can explain this scientific fact better. So, you know, I guess it goes two ways where you help in order to help the judge or the jury understand your science better. You work with the attorney, you know, so that they're able to ask you the right questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess
this
it goes
is
the
really
other way
interesting.
Around also.
Yeah. This
Sorry?
Is really interesting. I mean, this is just one case. This is just really interesting. This is one case where we have two different professional communities in which there has to be a coming together of being able to share information in a meaningful way when they have very different vocabularies between them. And this is actually true in lots of other professions also that have to make decisions about environmental issues, in which being able to communicate with each other effectively, getting across that language barrier when, you know, each profession has their very own, not only the different kind of words, even words that are the same but have very specific meanings in different contexts. And
I want to echo that.
This is an extreme example of that.
I would like Mona to make a list. Mona, you had about 6 or 8 words right at the beginning in which mm-hmm. lawyers and scientists use the same terms, but they use them in different ways. And that set itself, to me, is crucial.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. I'm happy to share my notes if that's of any help. I'm happy to do that.
If you're comfortable
useful.
With posting them, we could put them right on the website. I'm sorry I talked over you. Go ahead.
I think this would be very useful in general introductory college-level classes that are targeted at science, technology, and society, for instance. And it's
mm-hmm.
where you, in any adult forum where you get an intersection of people from different disciplines, this would be a terrific way for them to have a very smart discussion about how science informs the legal system. And boy, it would be great just to kick off right with these differences in vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Good.
Okay, are there any other
really
questions? Go ahead.
I just said I'm very grateful for this discussion. It's really helped me a lot just listening to you all and answering some of your questions. It's really helpful to me personally. Thank you.
Thank you, Mona.
This is Linda.
Yes, thank you very much. This is.
Say that again.
This is Linda Thursday calling in from William Mitchell College of Law. And
oh,
hi, Linda.
I am so glad that I was able to listen to Mona's presentation, and she did a very good job in explaining the program, and she was a delight to have here at our program.
Oh, thank you, Linda. Sure. Linda Thorsted is from William Mitchell College of Law, and she is one of the people behind this terrific academy. So thank you so much for joining in, Linda.
Yes.
Linda, are
thank
you a
you
lawyer?
I am. I have a PhD in geography, and I have worked with lawyers for 17 years, so I'm kind of crossing the border between the groups.
Okay, somebody at the interface of professions.
Yes. So we developed this program together, two lawyers and I, and then working with the National Science Foundation and David Verardo at the atmospheric section there. And it's been a great experience. We've learned a lot from each other, both groups. And so far, we've had 64 participants, EWTA fellows, we call them, over the last 3 years. And we're still learning a lot from each other. And it's been a tremendous experience.
That's great. Well, I don't know if you are, but if you're not, or if other people at the college are interested, I invite you to become a member of our group, the Clean Network, because what I would like this to be a venue for is a place where people with very different professional expertise can come and begin to share their ideas and their language so that people can begin to communicate more effectively across these different professions.
Absolutely. I agree wholeheartedly.
Okay, well, you can anybody else is interested, you can send me an email and I can add you to the listserv, but you can communicate that through Mona because she can get it to me.
Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other questions or comments?
Tamara? I came on later. I would have offered this at the beginning of our session, but I wanted to pick up on the epiphany thread that was running through the listserv the last couple of weeks. And Jean and I have been talking about that, and Jean, are you still on right now?
I am.
Okay. Jean had an epiphany about 20 years ago and has been working on a library of climate change. And within the Climate Literacy Network, we often talk about how much we need to go beyond just the scientific information that is there, but along the lines of providing a broad range of climate change information. Jean has worked on that really hard and has just first developed his information on a CD that he was distributing and now has a website. So, Jean, do you want to say just a minute about that? And I'd like the Climate Literacy Network to consider having Jean share that resource with the group. And maybe, having looked at it myself, I think the group might benefit from a 10 or 15-minute orientation to it at some point, in order to make it most useful to the group.
Well, absolutely. Okay. I would love to schedule him to give a talk sometime, but go ahead, Gene, and describe it now.
Well, the CD has accumulated about 2,500 articles about climate change, which I have summarized with a slideshow, PowerPoint slideshow, which I first developed in the beginning of 2007, and it's gone through a few thousand updates. The website has just gone up in the last several weeks, and it has those same articles, and it has a lot of illustrations, many but not all of the illustrations, which are primarily graphs, maps, a few tables, and probably more than 1,000 illustrations, are drawn either from the articles in those articles on the website, which are also on the CD, or from elsewhere in the literature. And it covers the entire gamut. I mean, we've got probably close to 1,000 articles on impacts, or a couple hundred. There's 100 probably on price and carbon emissions. There's a lot of stuff on how the science works, history of warming and CO2 for the last 600 million years. It gets finer resolution as you get closer to the present. History of what's happened with ice, how that affects sea levels, speculation on how that might affect what past paleoclimate history says on sea levels in the somewhat near future. There's quite a bit of influence on the food supply and what climate change has been doing and is expected to do to the food supply. Let me just take a look quickly at some of the other page titles. Page titles include, and they're typically 150 articles per page, overviews, a lot of that stuff's from the IPCC, Stern Review, National Climate Assessment, and so forth, heating, ice, water, no water, carbon sinks and sources, food, bio-impacts, sea level, weather changes, etc., costs, conflicts, other impacts and adaptation, fossil fuels and nukes, renewables, energy use, government and other. There's also that's on there. So that's the brief view in some sense of both the CD and the website. The website is much more richly illustrated than the CD. And the bio impact.
But Frank, if you could send Jane could send the URL for that and sort of describe it in a sentence or so what it is, to send it out to the listserv, that would be really helpful. And
okay,
we could, if you're interested, to sort of give a more. Okay,
I can tell you the URL. It's easy to remember, but I'll send that out to the listserv also. The URL is www.globalwarming-sowhat.com. There's no spaces. And Jane and I will send that URL around and probably a little bit about it.
That is super.
Terrific. Thanks a lot. Okay, well, with that, we will end our conversation today. We have another presentation, I believe, next week. Stephanie Fearman from Columbia University is going to talk about Polar Future Coast Climate Change Education Partnership Phase 2 Project. So we'll have that conversation next week. Thanks, everybody, for calling in.
Yes, thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Ona.